600 years ago, there lived a man named Orban. Just the one name, sort of like a 15th century Beyoncé or Oprah. Except Orban wasn't a celebrity. He was a cannon maker. And not just any cannon maker, but the best maker of cannons in the entire world. In the 1450s, his artillery was more destructive than any other weapon on the planet. It could lay waste to city walls, pound through the strongest defenses, and turn outposts to rubble. But there's no point in making such powerful cannons if you have nobody to sell them to. And it's only so much fun to shoot them on your own. So Orban rode for Constantinople, what we know today as Istanbul in modern-day Turkey. At the time, it was the seat of the powerful Byzantine Empire. Orban approached the emperor at the time, Constantine the 11th, and said, "Will you buy my cannons?" Orban told him, for the right price, he would build him as many cannons as he wanted. The emperor was tempted, but eventually told Orban that he couldn't afford his services, that he couldn't pay him what he was asking. So Orban left, but not before he had taken quite a few walks along the walls of the city to see what sort of fortifications were protecting the emperor who had scorned him. Not to be deterred, Orban left the walled city and went to see Sultan Mehmet II, who was in charge of the Ottoman capital. The Ottomans were a rival power to the Byzantines, but unlike the Byzantine emperor, Mehmet II didn't play hard to get. He spared no expense to get Orban on board. He showered him with gifts, flattered him, and told him that he would pay him whatever he needed. Orban was hired. And with his team of Ottomans, he began to cast a series of enormous, devastating cannons. Forging the cannons could only be done at a temperature of 1,000 degrees, so it's hard to imagine what the process involved in the 1450s. But thankfully, we don't have to imagine, because a traveler stopped by as they were forging the guns and helpfully reported what he saw, so that I can tell you about it 600 years later. Quote, "After the wood is thrown into the furnace, the founders and stokers strip naked, wearing nothing but their slippers, an odd kind of cap, which leaves nothing but their eyes visible, and thick sleeves to protect his arms. For after the fire has been alight in the furnaces for 24 hours, no person can approach on account of the heat, save he be attired in the above manner." End quote. Once the cannons were forged, the Ottomans helpfully brought them to Constantinople, the city that had decided to turn down Orban's services. The cannon was so large that it required 60 oxen to pull it. And the cannon wasn't exactly rapid fire. It took 3 hours to reload. But it played a crucial role in breaching the city's walls during the siege. Soon, Constantinople fell. The Byzantine Empire fell, and the Ottoman Empire took its place. But if Constantine the 11th had realized how much he needed to hire Orban, perhaps events would have unfolded a little bit differently. I'm Brian Kloss, and you're listening to Power Corrupts, the podcast where we shine a light onto the hidden and often nefarious forces that shape our world. Today, we're focusing on the politics of miscalculation, those oops moments that move history. Politics is so often viewed as a series of competing priorities. The Democrats want this and the Republicans want that, or China wants this and the European Union wants that. But the problem is that such a view of politics doesn't account for uncertainty. Those who are making decisions have imperfect information. They don't know what their opponent or their rival is going to do, or if what they say they want is actually what they really want. And on top of that, people are human. We make mistakes. This episode is about those mistakes, those moments where messing up has serious and potentially catastrophic consequences. There are so many stories on this topic that I couldn't cram all of them into this episode. But the ones that made the cut are wild. We're going to look at how killing sparrows ended up killing millions of people. How a superstitious dictator destroyed his country's economy by following his lucky numbers. How easy it is to stumble into a war that neither side wants to be in. And why it's important to set your watches and clocks correctly when preparing a covert invasion. But first, we're going to start with a story about bats.
Okay, I have the phone up to my face. My name is Kara Jaimo, and I'm a freelance writer.
And I started by asking Kara how she ended up covering the weirdest story about bats that you've never heard before.
I was actually researching a way longer piece. I was in Austin, Texas, and I was looking to learn everything I could about Mexican free-tailed bats. So I was in a bookstore in Texas, and I was kind of flipping through, I don't know if you'd call it the bat section, but whatever section had bats in it. There was a few pages on these bat bombs. And I remember I took a picture with my phone of the pages because I was like, this is really, really strange.
Bat bombs are pretty much exactly what they sound like.
So a bat bomb, put most simply, is a bomb filled with bats. Most bombs, you know, they're filled with explosives. You drop them, they break open, and something explodes. In this case, it was almost like a bomb turducken.
For you non-American listeners, a turducken is a Thanksgiving delicacy for those who aren't content to just have one bird as part of their feast. Here's former NFL commentator John Madden explaining what a turducken is during a Thanksgiving broadcast.
The turducken, this thing here, is a deboned duck stuffed in a deboned chicken stuffed in a deboned turkey. With stuffing, now you're talking, and that has eight legs.
And Kara's analogy is exactly right. The bat bomb followed the same principle.
So the bomb had an external casing, but then within the bomb, there were a lot of live bats, each holding their own small bomb. So when this bomb fell, it would break open, the bats would be released, they would fly and hopefully roost in small areas, and then their own small bombs would go off. So instead of having a big explosion, you would have a lot of very small explosions.
You might think that bat bombs sound like the brainchild of some mad scientist, but you'd be wrong. They were, in fact, the brainchild of an only slightly mad dentist.
Named Dr. Lytle S. Adams. This was during World War II when a lot of Americans were really invested in the war effort and trying to figure out what unique contributions they could make. Dr. Adams was a dentist, so perhaps he had sort of a fiendishly creative mind. I don't know. I don't want to generalize too much about dentists, but he had spent some time in the Southwest, and there are a lot of Mexican free-tailed bats in the South and the Southwest, and they're very impressive when they fly out at night to do their hunting for bugs. They kind of whoosh out in this great crowd of bats. Something about seeing those bats or having seen those bats inspired him to think up this bat bomb idea. This is the part that I wish I could see inside his head to kind of trace the moment where all these things came together and he thought, okay, I've seen these bats and this is what I can do with them. You know, that's the part that remains opaque. But he quickly came up with the idea that bats could somehow be used for military technology. He started capturing them and studying them, and then eventually he drew up this plan for the bomb.
Now, there's a lot of people in the world who come up with crazy ideas like this. For example, one of my grandparents' friends, when I was a kid, told me that he had the idea to make cheese puffs that were filled with helium, so that when you opened the bag, they would float around the room, offering an immediately fun way to start any party. Plus, there would be the added bonus of everyone's voice changing. But he couldn't get his cheese puffs invention off the ground, so to speak, because he didn't have friends in high enough places. But the bat bomb dentist was different.
He was pals with Eleanor Roosevelt.
So Lytle Adams wrote a letter outlining the bat bomb idea and how it could transform the American war effort.
The letter was very impassioned, and I'm pretty sure it came with little blueprints. Franklin Roosevelt actually read it, and he forwarded it along to the head of wartime intelligence with a note that said, This man is not a nut. It sounds like a perfectly wild idea, but is worth looking into. And so people actually did start looking into it.
FDR's seal of approval was all that was needed to kickstart the bat bomb research program.
It got surprisingly far along. They had a lot of bats that formed into their own little bat air force. They were in Washington doing tests. A few pretty accomplished people designed the actual prototypes that were tested. One of them was Louis Pfizer, who invented military napalm. He put together this big bomb casing and then these small capsules that the bats could be inside. And then for each bat, he made the tiny bomb. So he actually designed it so that the reagents would be separated by a thin wire. And the bats, when they moved eventually, would trip the bomb. So he built in like a bat-controlled time lapse so that it wouldn't explode immediately. They put a lot of time into it.
And the prototype was weird, but it seemed sort of promising.
They built a prototype of the bomb. It looked like a pretty normal bomb, but inside it was like a little bat dorm room. There were a lot of cardboard trays that bats could hang out in and be asleep until it was their time to shine. They would fly and roost in small areas where they couldn't necessarily be found. Then they would chew through the string that connected the bomb to them and leave. The bomb would stay inside the structure. Then the kind of time-lapse element would kick in. Copper chloride would dissolve a steel wire, which tripped a firing pin, ignited the capsule. And if there were enough little fires in particular buildings, the whole city could go down that way, they thought.
There were some initial challenges. For example, to put a bat in a bomb, you had to make it hibernate so that the bomb could be safely transported. So the bats were all put into ice cube trays to cool them down and to make them hibernate. And amazingly, that worked. So now all that was left was actual testing before the bat bombs were used in combat.
They made mock-up villages and tried to set the bomb upon them. So they gave the project an official name. They called it Project X-Ray. They did a trial run in Utah that went really well. The bats successfully burned down their mock-up settlement. Engineers were able to kind of figure out how effective they might be.
The chief chemist on the project got excited when he saw the results of the first test. He calculated that a normal bombing run over an enemy city would unleash between 167 and 400 fires per bombing load. The bat bombs, he concluded, would be far more destructive. They would start 3,625 to 4,748 fires. But the next test didn't go quite according to plan.
This time the bats actually broke out of the bomb. They escaped with their explosives. They left them around the test range and burned the whole test range down. And the bats then kind of roosted under this fuel tank and were pleased with themselves.
The fires also destroyed a general's car, which is a pretty good way to get a program shut down. Plus, there was something else going on at the time, also in New Mexico, called the Manhattan Project. And that showed a bit more promise than the bat bombs. So after spending $2 million on the zany military advice of a dentist, the project was shut down. For his part, Dr. Adams didn't give up on his bomb inventions. He actually tried to find a way to bomb the American prairies with seeds as a quicker way of planting. And when that didn't work, he invented a vending machine for fried chicken, which inexplicably didn't catch on. But he never gave up on the bat bombs.
And he actually defended his bat bomb idea until his death. He said that it actually would have been a much better way to conclude the war because it could have destroyed buildings and infrastructure, but without the kind of loss of life and lasting impacts of the atom bomb.
There's a pretty good lesson here in this instance of miscalculation, the moral of the story, so to speak.
Don't underestimate bats. If you're doing a plan that involves bats, remember that they have minds and needs of their own. They're not built to human specifications, and they're not necessarily going to do what you want. I think that's kind of a lesson that can be learned from a lot of different military animal stories, and it's something I try to keep in mind.
Thankfully, the bat bombs didn't do too much damage other than destroying part of a military base and a general's car. But when it comes to the high-stakes arena of political decision-making, the consequences of a screw-up are rarely so small. In fact, sometimes getting something wrong, even a little bit wrong, can kill millions of people. That's a speech by Mao, shortly after he came to power in the Chinese Revolution of 1949. Known to history as a monstrous tyrant, Mao started off with one admirable goal: to eradicate disease and vermin that spread it, so that public health in China could be improved for the millions of peasants who faced dying from preventable disease. At the time, there were pathogens everywhere. Tuberculosis, bubonic plague, malaria, smallpox, and hookworm were common throughout the population. Cholera spread unchecked. And in some parts of the country, as many as 1 in 3 infants died shortly after birth. It was a public health disaster. So Mao launched a massive vaccinations campaign and tried to implement other public health measures as well. But central to his policy was a new initiative that he launched in 1958. It was called the Four Pests Campaign, packaged as part of the so-called Great Leap Forward. The idea was that patriotism and duty, and a lot of communist coercion, would compel Chinese citizens to follow Mao and do whatever he said. And what he said was this: eliminate 4 pests that carry disease. Sparrows, rats, flies, and mosquitoes. These were branded the enemies of the Chinese people. Posters were printed showing glorious Chinese communist children shooting sparrows with slingshots. In one propaganda poster, there's a long Chinese sword that stabbed through all 4 of the pests, the blade running through a sad-looking fly, mosquito, sparrow, and rat. In another poster, a group of young children band together to use a basket to capture and kill a sparrow that has fallen from its nest. And there's even one with military overtones, in which a patriotic Chinese man wields a fly swatter like it's a rifle, brandishing it proudly for the defense of the realm. The drum beats, the party calls, the workers sing. For the health campaign, everything must be clean. We know we can change the face of the earth. In another film, the workers sing in unison. Pest-free areas are glorious. Let's wipe out all the flies, bugs, mosquitoes, and rats. The sparrows, by the way, weren't hunted because of their ability to spread disease, but rather because they ate grains, diminishing production. The government proclaimed somewhat absurdly that, quote, "birds are public animals of capitalism." And if your family or business or village could produce the most sparrow carcasses in your region, you'd get publicly rewarded. At one point, a coordinated effort to kill sparrows in Peking, now known as Beijing, enlisted 3 million people who went out into the streets at the same time to hunt the birds. In one of the more bizarre consequences of the anti-sparrow campaign, some birds actually took refuge in embassies, the only place where people weren't hunting them. A group of sparrows nested in the Polish embassy. And when they were discovered, the embassy was surrounded by people with drums, who banged them relentlessly to frighten the birds away from resting in the trees. And the sparrows died from exhaustion. The messaging, combined with the coercion of the communist state, worked. Chinese citizens killed an estimated 1 billion sparrows with a B, 1.5 billion rats, 200 million pounds of flies, and nearly 25 million pounds of mosquitoes. It was, by the metrics of the campaign, an unmitigated success story. And to be fair, some diseases stopped spreading through the population. Mission accomplished, right? Unfortunately, Mao and his advisors didn't have a great understanding of ecology in 1958. Sure, sparrows eat grains and they eat seeds, but they also eat insects. They're crucial for population control of far more damaging pests. And when a billion sparrows were eliminated from the food chain virtually overnight, that meant that locusts could reproduce without being eaten. The locust population in China exploded. Swarms of them spread across the countryside, wiping out entire crops. The effects were made worse by other aspects of government policy around collectivization, too. And as crops failed and famine spread, the Chinese realized that they needed sparrows. They even started trying to import the birds from the Soviet Union. But it was too late. Crops across the entire country were gone. And people began to starve. One party official later remembered the events of 1959 vividly. Quote, "I went to one village and saw 100 corpses. Then another village and another 100 corpses. No one paid attention to them. People said that dogs were eating the bodies. Not true, I said. The dogs had long ago been eaten by the people." When the famine finally ended after roughly 3 years of crop failure, between 20 and 45 million people had starved to death. I imagine that many of you are stuck at home at the moment, or finding yourself with a bit more time on your hands. But that time can be spent more productively with The Great Courses Plus, an educational streaming service that makes learning easy and accessible, whether you're on the go or at home. And you can use The Great Courses Plus to learn about just about anything you could imagine, taught directly by experts who really know what they're talking about. I've been social distancing while listening to the course on forensic history, crimes, frauds, and scandals. It's got everything from the corruption that plagued Warren G. Harding's presidency to history's most notorious killers, like Jack the Ripper, or the bizarre story of the Tylenol killings. And they link those stories to new developments in technology to show how forensics can help solve crimes from the past. Power Corrupt's listeners now can get a full month for free while learning about everything from the rise of Rome to honing your cooking skills and everything in between. Just go to the special URL for Power Corrupt's listeners, thegreatcoursesplus.com/power. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/power. We're now going to stay in Asia, but we're going to move to one of China's neighbors, Myanmar. And here to help us understand this strange story of miscalculation based on a dictator's lucky number is Michael Peel.
I'm the European diplomatic correspondent of the Financial Times and the author of a new book called The Fabulists, The World's New Rulers, Their Myths and the Struggle Against Them.
It's a great book, by the way, if you're interested in understanding the new wave of lying authoritarian leaders who have come to power in recent years.
This is the product of 10 years and more of being able to report and having had fantastic opportunities to report from different places in the world, including West Africa, the Middle East, and Southeast Asia.
And Michael is going to introduce us to one of the stranger characters of politics in the post-World War II era, Ne Win, a dictator who made many miscalculations. And today, we're going to focus on just three of them.
Ne Win was the man who took over Myanmar as military dictator in the 1960s, an army officer, increasingly dominated the country, took it in the Burmese way of socialism, in which the country turned in on itself, of autarky, basically, and became increasingly personally erratic in his decision-making as well. And so it developed into a cult, not just of the military dictatorship, but of the one man and Ne Win's whims.
In 1966, Ne Win was welcomed to Washington for a state visit, where he gave a speech along the then-president, Lyndon Johnson.
Mr. President, First of all, may I express to you and Mrs. Johnson and to the American people our heartfelt thanks for the warm welcome extended to me and my wife and the members of my party.
As a side note, Myanmar was known as Burma until 1989. But back in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, Ne Win had nearly complete control over what happened in Burma. And so one day, on December 6, 1970, he decided to make a change.
Myanmar, for quite some time, drove on the left-hand side of the road, but there was an arbitrary decision during the dictatorship to suddenly change it, to drive on the right-hand side of the road. As usual, there was no reason given for this, and possible explanations have varied from, you know, that it was an attempt to distance Myanmar from the colonial era, because of course the British drive on the left, to some kind of superstition that Ne Win or his aides had been told that they ought to change it for some kind of astrological reason. The effect of this was that a lot of cars on Myanmar's roads are not suited to drive on them, because they are cars that are driving on the right-hand side of the road, but they are right-hand drive cars.
The astrological explanation may well be true, because, as we'll come to in a moment, astrology is very important in Myanmar. But regardless of why the change happened, as you might expect, there were some unintended consequences. Consequences that are still in place. Because, to this day, Myanmar mostly imports cars made for the other side of the road.
It makes overtaking extremely dangerous, essentially, especially if you're behind a truck. It's you as the passenger who has to look out and see if there's a car coming the other way and then tell the driver to go. And that you have buses which have doors which are meant to open onto the sidewalk. But of course, because they're the opposite configuration, they open into the middle of the carriageway. And it's just a small example, but also a deadly one, of how, you know, a dictator's whims can echo through and have all kinds of destructive effects on society.
From that point on, he became basically an authoritarian leader from that point on until 1988. So Ne Win was quite instrumental in introducing Burmese ways to socialism.
Here to help us understand Ne Win a bit better is a professor from my alma mater, Carleton College in Minnesota.
Are you recording?
We're rolling.
Yeah, rolling, yes. We are. They're rolling. Okay, good.
Someone who grew up in Myanmar and who played an important role in its history.
My name is Thum Minh, an associate professor of political science and environmental study at Carleton.
And one of the biggest miscalculations that Ne Win made in office happened in the late 1980s, which we'll get to in a moment. But first, you have to understand that astrology, numbers, and days of the week have all played a big role in Burmese politics. Now, before we think that that's super weird, let's keep in mind that superstitions persist in a big way in the West, too. Take the example of the 13th floor. A review by the company Otis Elevators in 2002 found that roughly 85% of buildings in the U.S. that are taller than 13 stories don't actually have a 13th floor. They just go from 12 to 14 in order to avoid an unlucky number. But in Myanmar, numbers and days of the week play an even bigger role.
Critical in day-to-day decision of people, even whether you should go to school today or whether you should take exam today, whether you should start your business today. So based on these astrology and also the day that Monday to Sunday. Yeah, future prediction about based on your past and position of the sun and the stars and things like this.
The creation of Burma as an independent state was on January 4th, 1948, and the time of day slated for independence was 4:20 in the morning, which was viewed as an auspicious time.
It was at an early hour, specially chosen by Burmese astrologers, that Rangoon marked Burma's full assumption of independence. In place of the Union Jack, the Burmese national flag was hoisted with all due ceremony.
And then there's the days of the week, which are viewed as central to someone's future, so much so that they're tied to names, such that if you hear someone's name, you can tell whether they were born on a Saturday, a Sunday, or a Tuesday.
When I was growing up, I was born and raised in a small village in a remote area of Burma. Numbers were less important than days, like Monday to Sundays. The day you were born, the day you are going to do something is far more important than whether you are doing number 9 or number 8 or number 7. If you are born on Saturday, you are represented by dragon. Sunday is a galone, which is a mythical bird who would actually equally fight with the dragon, which would be said on Saturday. If you hear my name, or my name is Tun, start with Ta Ta Dada Na, which is a Burmese alphabet. Ta Ta Dada Na represent the Saturday. So if you hear a Burmese name start with Ta, Tun, then you know that person is born on Saturday. So that is how important the dates are. So if you hear Ka Ka Gaga Nga, which will be representing Monday, if you hear somebody named Carol or Kat or Kathy or Kao Mian or Kao Miat or Ka Ka Gaga Nga sound, that would be, you can tell, oh, that person must be born on Monday. And 90%, 99% all the way, you'll be right.
Nay Win was even more superstitious than most. He was said to have practiced a sort of arcane belief in something called Yadaya. In one instance, when he was apparently told by his astrologer that he would be assassinated, the dictator bought a bunch of meat, put it in front of a mirror, stomped on it with his feet, and then shot his own reflection in the mirror. The idea was that the phony bloodshed that he created would ensure that the prophesized real bloodshed never came to pass. But Nay Win was also a man obsessed by numbers. He believed that his life was defined by one lucky number in particular. The number 9. Earlier on in life, an astrologer told him that if he followed the number 9, he would live to be 90 years old, quite a feat for someone who was born in 1910. And so in 1987, Nay Win decided to do something radical in pursuit of that promised long life. And he decided to try to kill two birds with one stone, to follow his lucky number, and to stick it to merchants who he viewed as an economic elite that was becoming too powerful.
The talk in town at the time was that if Nay Win want to punish these wealthy elite who control commodity prices, he would have to sort of devalue those currency and their saving would be wiped out. Therefore, they'll be economically crashed, so to speak. And so Nay Win then would be able to maintain his sort of policy and his path of governing.
Nay Win figured that if he messed with the currency that was in circulation, it would hurt the fat cat merchants the most, because they had a huge amount of cash on hand.
He believed that people who were wealthy, who have a lot of saving at home, which would be stacks of 100 jiat currencies and 75 and so on currency, they keep in these duffel bags at home. That was how people saved their saving because banking system was so poor. Day-to-day economy run by the private sector was conducted by cash in that sense.
So Nay Win did something truly unpredictable. Miscalculation number 2. He simply eliminated all the currency that was in circulation. It was no longer valid, simply because it was not divisible by the number 9. If you had a 100 jiat banknote, that was all of a sudden null and void. Instead, you could only deal with banknotes of 90 or of 45.
So he devalued the Myanmar Burmese currency, 100 jiat then, and then others, smaller notes as well, and replaced with 90.
From the dictator's astrologer to the economy, just like that. Everybody who had their life savings in denominations of 100 was just wiped out. And rather than targeting the wealthy merchants, that devaluation hit everyone, and it hit them hard. The Burmese economy was crippled.
It turned out the day-to-day street vendors are the ones that suffer immediately because they are the ones actually using cash to operate day-to-day shops on the streets, sidewalks, and so on. So that was a miscalculation from Nay Win's part in that sense. Like my brother, who has a shop on the street in Yangon, and myself, I was selling stuff in the market. I have hunted jet notes in my pocket, under my pillow, some saving for the next day, sort of running. So people like me, my brothers, and you know, the middle class and lower people, if we can call middle class then, in 1987, were immediately affected because the next day you don't have cash to buy even a product that you would sell it for profit. And so that was immediate impact. That really was the beginning of 1987 student movement, I would say.
The broken economy proved a catalyst for protests. Protests that were led by students. And Tune was a student at the time, someone who was eager to see his country open up to the world and become a less insular society. He became an outspoken advocate of the student protests. But in order for the students to beat the dictator, they needed auspicious numbers on their side too. And when it came to beating the number 9, there was really only one viable choice.
The number 8 is a very powerful. You can sort of win over 9, which is Ne-Win's number. And so this is sort of a non-scientific tea shop kind of conversation among the student activists and local activists thinking, okay, we should pick 8. 8 is coming, meaning that August 8, 1988 is 4/8, quarter eights. 8/8/88 is the number that would be representing the power to overthrow the most powerful, which would be 9, Ne-Win, right? So we then begin with that discussion and picked 8/8/88 to be National Uprising Day.
The 8/8/88 protests, August 8, 1988, were enormous. Monks, children, students, and workers all banded together and took to the streets. Authorities tried to crack down on the protesters, but there were just so many of them. Our best guess of the scale of the protests was around 4 million people, about 1 in every 10 people who lived in the country at the time, the equivalent of more than 30 million Americans taking to the streets today. Still, the military opened fire on the protesters and used brutality to try to disperse them. It was a bloodbath. During the protests, between 3,000 and 10,000 people were killed. But the protesters vowed to fight for democracy. They even developed a song, the Anthem of 8/8/88, the showdown of the pro-democracy eights versus the number 9 dictatorship. The song was called We Won't Be Satisfied Till the End of the World. It was written by a protest leader over candlelight in his home as he sought to create a form of nonviolent resistance to Ne-Win, the dictator who had destroyed an economy. And the anthem of the protesters was set to the tune of the hit Kansas song, Dust in the Wind. The 1988 protests ended with a horrific crackdown. But the spirit of the protests embedded in that song wouldn't die so easily. But they also led to the rise of Aung San Suu Kyi as a national figure in Burma, someone who could come to define Burmese resistance to authoritarianism for a generation.
The generals realized that their position needed to be shored up in some way, and that they were faced with a situation where they'd already carried out massacres during the 1988 uprising, but there was still this strong political will for change. And then in 1990, the military held an election, but it backfired badly for them. Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy won by a landslide, and the generals simply ignored the result. And they jailed many members of the NLD, and Aung San Suu Kyi herself was under house arrest for much of the next two decades.
Michael, by the way, has interviewed Aung San Suu Kyi in person. She's a maddening case study of someone who seemed so promising and later ended up replicating the forms of oppression that she claimed to oppose. You can read all about it in his excellent book, The Fabulists. But we're going to move on to miscalculation number 3, which was a decision that Myanmar made to relocate its capital to the middle of nowhere. It has 20-lane highways. It has fast Wi-Fi. Hotels are everywhere. The only one thing it doesn't have is people.
Naypyidaw is the capital city of Myanmar and is really the most extraordinary place. It's like the most extreme example you can imagine of a country which suddenly decided to move its capital city and build it in the middle of nowhere. The generals did this in the 2000s, and there's never been any formal reason why it was done. Some people say it was to do with security paranoia. They were worried that having the capital near the coast in Yangon would been vulnerable to outside invasion. It's full of wide, long roads between official buildings. It's very hard to move surreptitiously. You can't, there are no back alleyways for people to sort of gather in or move through stealthily. And indeed, near the parliament, there's a highway which is 10 lanes in both directions. People said that, maybe this was so planes could land there and take off from there, although the surface looks a little bit undulating for that to happen safely.
By area, it's 6 times larger than New York City. Officially, the city's population is 1 million, but most people suspect the real number is far, far lower than that.
Government has moved there, but nobody else. It's not an organic, thriving city. It's government, it's a few hotels to service it and a few shopping malls and so forth, but it's a ghost town, essentially. And so you drive through to this parliamentary compound, which is sprawling and has pagoda-like buildings where MPs and others have their offices.
And there you have it, the modern history of Myanmar in 3 miscalculations. Cars switched to the other side of the road for seemingly no reason at all. A currency devaluation that wrecked the economy all to follow the lucky number of the dictator. And a purpose-built capital city that has everything except for residents. On the other hand, perhaps Ne Win's currency devaluation wasn't a miscalculation after all. Remember how his astrologer told him that he'd live to be 90 if he followed his lucky number 9? Well, Ne Win died in 2002 at the age of 92. Miscalculations are a much bigger force in politics than bat bombs, cannon makers, and lucky numbers. They define so much of international relations and policymaking. In every major international event, there's an element of miscalculation, or at least the risk of miscalculation. This is particularly true when you're making decisions about war and peace, involving an adversary who isn't going to just tell you what he or she is actually thinking. In war, deception is the name of the game, so it creates a lot more uncertainty and a lot more scope for miscalculation. One of the best summaries of this phenomenon came from Donald Rumsfeld, the former Secretary of Defense who presided over the Iraq War in 2003. Love him or hate him, Rumsfeld was right about this seemingly convoluted statement that he made during the war. He got made fun of relentlessly for this, but he is making an important point.
As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
If you're confused by that, you're not alone. But what he's saying is crucial for understanding the risk of catastrophic miscalculation. In every political decision, those 3 categories exist. The known knowns, which is information that you need that you also have. The known unknowns, which is information that you need that you are aware that you don't have. And then there's the unknown unknowns, the information you aren't even aware exists, so you're not even looking for it. The unknown unknowns provide the greatest scope for miscalculation. Rumsfeld is actually drawing on a formulation that first made an appearance from psychologists in the 1950s. It's a way of thinking that was big at NASA as they tried to plan for the worst during missions. And it's a type of thinking that Saddam Hussein should have used not just in 2003, but in 1991.
Wars aren't accidents, they're car crashes. They're people wanting to crash their car. So it's not like an accident of nature. It's choices that politicians make.
That's Corey Shockey, the Director of Foreign and Defense Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute and a contributing writer to The Atlantic. But of course, there are times when car crashes happen because the drivers are reckless, or they're unwilling or unable to accurately understand the risk that they face and the mistakes they might be making. So let's take a step back to 1990. It hadn't even been a year since the fall of the Berlin Wall, and the U.S. was clearly on the cusp of winning the Cold War. President George H.W. Bush was keen on establishing what he called a New World Order, a system of international law in which countries couldn't just invade other countries. And Saddam Hussein was thinking about invading Kuwait, Iraq's tiny oil-rich neighbor to the south. But Saddam wanted to know, what would the U.S. do if he invaded? Would America sit on the sidelines, or would America act?
Both the American ambassador in Baghdad and the Iraqi government dramatically underestimated how much the George H.W. Bush White House was prioritizing international law and a new global order of cooperation among great powers.
Saddam Hussein believed that the U.S. was preoccupied with other more pressing issues.
The United States wouldn't care about Kuwait, didn't really care about the politics of the countries of the Persian Gulf. And because it was focused on the collapse of the Soviet Union, German unification, the settlement of a post-Cold War order in Europe, that this would be tangential, and it was a huge opportunity for Iraq to reset the power relationships in the Gulf.
But Saddam was getting mixed signals. The White House seemed to be making it clear that America would act. And then Saddam Hussein met with April Glaspie, an American diplomat.
A partial transcript released by the Iraqis quoted Glaspie as saying the U.S. wanted better relations with Iraq and had no opinion on Iraq's dispute with Kuwait. Today, Glaspie rejected suggestions that she inadvertently gave Saddam the green light to invade.
Did you say we have no opinion on the Arab-Arab conflicts like your border disagreement with Kuwait?
Yes, that was one part of my sentence. The other part of my sentence was, but we insist that you settle your disputes with Kuwait non-violently.
Saddam thought that he was reading between the lines and that Glaspie was giving him a wink and a nudge that America would, in fact, sit on the sidelines if he invaded Kuwait.
What they dramatically underestimated was how much in President George H.W. Bush's mind and Jim Baker, the Secretary of State, that resetting the international order was about creating a rules-based order where those rules would be neutrally abided by the great powers.
At 2 a.m. local time on August the 2nd, Iraqi troops crossed the border into Kuwait, and its army of just 20,000 men was swept aside in a matter of hours by a force of tanks and infantry, battle-hardened by their eight-year war against Iran.
That miscalculation, that misinterpretation of a diplomatic signal, started a war that Saddam Hussein couldn't possibly win. And it all kicked off live during a nightly newscast in the United States.
We're going to dump out of that piece by Gary Shepard at the moment and go back to him live on the telephone, for he has an up-to-date report. Gary.
Peter, I am looking directly west from our hotel now, and throughout the entire sky there are flashes of light. It appears to be some sort of anti-aircraft fire, a couple of flashes on the horizon now. Something is definitely underway here.
Operation Desert Storm was probably the most lopsided war in modern history. There were between 25,000 and 50,000 Iraqi soldiers who were killed. By comparison, Iraq killed 147 coalition troops, meaning that roughly 238 Iraqi soldiers died for every Western soldier that they killed. Saddam Hussein had badly misjudged the situation. he interpreted one offhanded comment from an American diplomat as a signal from the United States government. He acted based on that misinterpretation, and his soldiers and his country paid the price. But this episode isn't really about bats or really about Saddam Hussein. It's about the ongoing and very real risk of catastrophic miscalculation. In a world overloaded by information, we can make serious mistakes. And it can happen in new ways, too. Rather than not having access to data, we're overloaded by it. And that can create another sort of hubris, thinking that everything is a known known, so to speak, while not being on the lookout for unknown unknowns. And there are other possibilities for miscalculation that are new, too. Take social media, for example. In late 2016, the Minister of Defense for Pakistan, a country that has nuclear weapons, shared a fake story about a threat from Israel toward Pakistan. The defense minister thought it was real, so he went on Twitter and he threatened Israel with nuclear weapons. That's terrifying, because even though nuclear war didn't break out that time, there's always the risk that powerful people with control over destructive arsenals will miscalculate based on bad or faulty or fake information. And then, of course, there's also the scope for miscalculation when leaders don't seem to be able to make up their own mind. Take, for example, how Donald Trump has, in the span of a year or two, gone from threatening North Korea with, quote, fire and fury, and insulting Kim Jong-un as a rocket man who has a smaller button than Donald Trump,
little rocket man,
to saying that the two have exchanged, quote, love letters and have, quote, fallen in love.
He wrote me beautiful letters. We fell in love.
What are leaders to make of that? Trump supporters say that his unpredictability is good for the United States. But if other world leaders misinterpret signals that are obviously difficult to interpret, then the risk of catastrophe grows considerably. Corey, by the way, who served in the White House, says that we can avoid those types of mistakes if we do a lot of contingency planning and if we're transparent about our goals.
So I wanted to also ask you just from personal experience. I mean, you worked at the highest echelons of national security in the United States. How much does miscalculation come into sort of daily thinking? Is it something where you try to create protocols to avoid it or take any measures to sort of mitigate the risk of miscalculation?
We make fewer big mistakes because our system is so open to ideas and influence from outside the system. When we do American strategy well, we capitalize on the openness of our system and develop robust arguments for and against the policies that we are advocating. And I notice, as somebody who spends a lot of time working on military strategy, that the American military has a sort of natural red teaming process. They call it a pony blanket, right, or a horse blanket, where you figure out what you're going to do, what are the adversary's options, then what do we do if they take any of these choices? It's a way to be methodical about thinking about where could we be wrong and where could it take us to a place we don't want to go, and how do we develop a strategy that's robust against that kind of failure. It tends, in the civilian parts of the American government, to be less methodical and to be much more dependent on the individuals placed in the process, which is always a potential failure in the American system.
We're going to end today with two cautionary tales of miscalculation with a simple message. Check your work twice before moving forward with any important plans. First, let's go back in time a few hundred years, to Sweden. It's 1625, and the king, Gustav Adolf II, decides to commission some fearsome warships. They are to be the technological marvel of the age, ships that will strike the fear of God into anyone who encounters them on the seas. The ship was to be known as the Vasa. However, as a result of logistical challenges for the shipbuilders, there were a lot of different people involved in the construction of the Vasa. Some of them were from the Amsterdam School of Shipbuilding, so to speak, and some were from the Stockholm School. That meant that some builders were measuring everything on one side of the boat in Swedish feet, and others were measuring everything on the other side of the boat in Amsterdam feet. The two measurements were different by around 1 inch, which may not seem like a lot, but it can add up during the course of building an entire ship. On August 10, 1628, thousands lined up to watch the Vasa make its maiden voyage. As its sails unfurled, everyone watched in awe. It was a calm day, with so little wind that just one man was in control of the massive sails on board the ship. And then, a light gust of wind, a barely imperceptible wind, came into the harbor. The lopsided ship fell over. The portals for its mighty guns flooded, and it sank after a voyage that lasted a few minutes. 53 people died. The captain was jailed for incompetence, when in reality it was the shipbuilders who had failed to follow a cardinal rule of life. Measure twice, cut once. Fast forward a few hundred years to 1961, when the U.S. government made a covert attempt to invade Cuba and overthrow the communist government of Fidel Castro. The operation, now infamous as the botched Bay of Pigs invasion, was, of course, a failure. But there is one little-known aspect of the invasion where the failure was just from miscalculation. There was supposed to be a convergence between the CIA's B-26 airplanes and some Navy jets that were supposed to converge over Cuba at 6:30 a.m. local time. It was to be a coordinated assault that would provide air support to the landing of a ground force of mostly Cuban exiles. The B-26s were based in Nicaragua. The Navy jets were based on the USS Essex, which was sailing close to Cuba. Here's the problem. Cuba and the USS Essex were in the Eastern time zone. Nicaragua, by contrast, is in the Central time zone. Nobody had specified which time zone to use. So when 6:30 a.m. Eastern time rolled around and the airplanes were supposed to converge, the B-26s were nowhere to be found. The pilots were probably having breakfast. They showed up, like clockwork, at 7:30 a.m. Cuba time, an hour after the Navy jets had already come and gone. So here are the takeaways from today. Be sure to synchronize your watches to the right time zone when making plans. Don't put bats in any bombs that you're making. Embrace the sparrows in your life. And if a cannon maker tries to sell you a really big cannon, always, always buy it, whatever the price, or otherwise, you'll live to regret it. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode or at least learned something new, please rate and review the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen. And if you're feeling really generous, tell your friends about the show and post about it on social media. We rely on word of mouth to get new listeners. Next episode, we'll be talking about the politics of pandemics. Are authoritarian governments actually better equipped to deal with pandemic outbreaks than democracies? Why did up to 100 million people die from the Spanish flu? And why is it a historical injustice that it's called the Spanish flu in the first place? What do mathematical modelers look for when trying to figure out how bad the current outbreak of the coronavirus is likely to be? And why, oh why, did a whole bunch of people start dancing relentlessly during what's called the Great Dancing Plague of 1518?
It's very mysterious. Nobody knows to this day what caused that disease.
Don't miss it. This episode was written and narrated by me, Brian Kloss. The executive producer was George McDonough, who also did the sound editing. Music by Scott Holmes. Goodbye for now.